From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It's a sad day when Washington, having recognized that we're standing on a mountain of lies, and proceeding to prosecute a war against a people that did not attack us.
Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. He was one of eight to vote against the House war spending bill last week that set a timetable for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. We go to Capitol Hill to speak with the Ohio representative and Democratic presidential candidate. Then a conversation with legendary publisher Andre Schifrin.
How much of American political idea has changed since the 40s and 50s? How much have we lost of what we wanted to do after the war? And how do ideas still get sent around the country? Are they disseminated in a way that's increasingly difficult with the control of the media that we now have?
Andre Schifrin was the publisher of Pantheon Books for 30 years and left to head up an independent press, The New Press. His new book is called A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has narrowly voted to keep an amendment calling for the withdrawal of U.S. combat troops from Iraq by March of next year. Republicans had tried to remove the provision from the bill that would fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but set the non-binding deadline. The final vote was 50-48. Republicans Gordon Smith of Oregon and Chuck Hagel voted with the Democrats. Hagel spoke on the Senate floor.
The United States must begin planning for a phased troop withdrawal from Iraq. The cost of combat in Iraq in terms of American lives, dollars, and world standing has been devastating for our country. The American people are demanding that we develop a bipartisan consensus for an honorable and responsible exit strategy from Iraq. If we fail to build a bipartisan foundation for an exit strategy, America will pay a high price for this blunder, one that we will have difficulty recovering from in the years ahead. Our actions today in the Congress begin this effort. Mr. President, I thank you and yield the floor.
Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas was the lone Democrat to vote with Republicans. Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut also voted against his old party.
The immediate question before us is direct. Should Congress impose a deadline for the withdrawal of our troops from Iraq? To that question, I answer no, no, no.
A final vote on the bill could come today. The amendment's passage all but assures Congress will send President Bush a bill calling for a withdrawal from Iraq. The House version passed last week calls for the withdrawal of combat troops by September of 2008. On Tuesday, White House spokesperson Dana Perino repeated President Bush's pledge to veto any bill calling for withdrawal.
Regardless of the success of our troops are achieving in the field, this bill would require their withdrawal. This and other provisions would place freedom and democracy in Iraq at grave risk, embolden our enemies, and undercut the administration's plan to develop the Iraqi economy. If this legislation were presented to the president, he would veto the bill.
In Iraq, local officials are reporting at least 45 deaths today after off-duty Shiite police went on a rampage to avenge a massive bombing in the northern town of Tal Afar. The officers are said to have roamed Sunni neighborhoods, rounded up men, and shot them execution style. The attacks follow a double truck bombing that killed 60 people in Tal Afar Tuesday. Another 150 were wounded. Several attacks were also reported around Baghdad. This is an unidentified Baghdad resident.
We appeal to every Muslim man and to those who believe in God to find a solution for Iraq. God is greatest. We are going crazy. Our families, women and children are being killed.
The violence comes as a new Pentagon assessment based on interviews with senior U.S. commanders says the U.S. military is in, quote, strategic peril. The assessment is authored by retired General Barry McCaffrey. He writes, quote, the population is in despair. Life in many of the urban areas is now desperate. A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit against former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld for the torture of prisoners in U.S. custody overseas. The American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights First had brought the case on behalf of nine former prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan. The suit said Rumsfeld had tacitly or directly authorized a series of abuses, including beatings, stabbings, shocks, burnings, and sexual humiliation. in his dismissal ruling. U.S. District Judge Thomas Hogan did acknowledge the men had been tortured and called the allegations horrifying. But he said they do not have constitutional rights to seek redress and that government officials are immune. Britain has begun unveiling evidence today it says proves Iran's capture of 15 British sailors took place in Iraqi waters. On Tuesday, British Prime Minister Tony Blair rejected a question of whether the seizure could be linked to the U.S. arrest of five Iranians in Iraq earlier this year.
In the end, it's a question really for the Iranian government as to whether they want to abide by international law or not. I hope that they do, and we're working hard to try and persuade them that that is a sensible thing to do.
In other news from Britain, a protester interrupted a service Tuesday to mark the 200th anniversary of Britain's abolition of slavery. The event came to a halt when the protester ran in front shouting, quote, "You should be ashamed and this is an insult." Tony Blair and Queen Elizabeth II were among those in attendance. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, reports are emerging between 200 and 500 people were killed in fighting last week in the capital, Kinshasa. The violence came as part of continuing clashes between government forces and supporters of former Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba. In the Gaza Strip, at least four people were killed and 20 wounded when a sewage reservoir burst open and flooded dozens of homes. Gaza Mayor Majed Abu Ramadan appealed for aid.
Authorities involved will do a proper technical analysis, and it's important to draw lessons how to prevent this. But what's also more important is to save these people. More than 350 families lost everything in their life.
In Egypt, opposition groups are rejecting the results of a referendum approving constitutional changes backed by Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. All of Egypt's opposition parties boycotted the vote and say turnout reached just 5%. The measure grants Mubarak new powers to dissolve parliament, weaken electoral oversight, and affirm emergency powers. This is George Ishak, deputy coordinator of the Kefaya movement.
We will not keep silent about this fraud. I am declaring in the name of Kefaya that we will confront this fabrication, and we will not stop confronting this regime until it falls, because this regime has no legal foundation. We will confront this in coordination with other political groups.
Back in the United States, FBI Director Robert Mueller acknowledged Tuesday the FBI has made hundreds of errors in its use of national security letters to access personal information of U.S. citizens. Mueller was testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was his first appearance at a hearing since an audit this month found numerous errors and possible breaches of the law. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said the Judiciary Committee will begin reexamining the FBI's broad authorities granted under the Patriot Act. A civil rights group is reporting an increasing number of innocent people are being denied transactions by businesses checking their names against the Treasury Department's terrorist watch list. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights says credit bureaus, health insurers, car dealerships, employers, and landlords have denied business to customers bearing similar names to those on the 6,000-plus list. In one case, a California man was denied a home loan after his credit report flagged his middle name, Hassan, as an alias for one of Saddam Hussein's sons. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow has announced his colon cancer has returned and spread to his liver. Snow was treated for colon cancer in 2005. Deputy Press Secretary Dana Perino is filling in his absence. In Florida, authorities in Bay County have been ordered to pay $2.4 million to the family of a 14-year-old who died at a juvenile boot camp last year. The teenager, Martin Lee Anderson, was initially said to have died of a complication from sickle cell blood disease, but a second autopsy later concluded he suffocated to death after guards beat him. The new fine comes on top of a $5 million settlement from the state of Florida earlier this month. In Vermont, eight peace activists were arrested Tuesday in a sit-in at the offices of independent Senator Bernie Sanders. The action was one of several to target lawmakers who have voted to continue war funding. And finally, in Chicago, a promised 15-minute press conference with Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez turned to less than 3 minutes Tuesday as Gonzalez ducked questions about the firing of the 8 U.S. attorneys. Gonzalez left the podium after taking just 3 questions. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the Democratic-led Senate has moved closer to passing a war spending bill that'll give President Bush $100 billion more for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and also require U.S. combat troops to begin withdrawing from Iraq. On Tuesday, Republican lawmakers attempted to pass an amendment removing the troop withdrawal plan from the bill. But the amendment was defeated by a 50-48 vote after Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska voted with the Democrats on the measure. President Bush has vowed to veto the legislation if it includes a timetable for withdrawal. Meanwhile, anti-war activists continue to pressure lawmakers to reject the bill as well because it allows for the war to continue for another year. In Burlington, Vermont, police arrested 8 protesters after they refused to leave the offices of Senator Bernie Sanders, who has been a longtime opponent of the war but supports the spending bill. Sanders said it would be counterproductive to vote against the spending bill. He said, quote, "That would mean voting with the Bush administration and congressional Republicans and handing a victory to those who want to continue and perhaps expand the war into neighboring countries." Last week, 8 anti-war Democrats voted against the supplemental spending bill when it came before the House. One of those lawmakers, Congressmember Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, joins us from Capitol Hill. Congressmember Kucinich is also running for the Democratic presidential nomination. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Congressman Kucinich.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. First of all, as you stand overlooking the Capitol, talk about your vote against the war funding bill.
We were given false choices. We were told that we either buy into President Bush's plan, which is to keep the war going indefinitely, or accept the Democratic version of the war in Iraq, which would keep the war going for another year or two. I say those choices weren't sufficient. The Democrats could have refused to send a bill forward. We didn't have to fund this war. We're not under any obligation to keep the war going. And yet our leaders took another path. Furthermore, Amy, you may be interested to know that the 2008 budget, which is before Congress today and which will be voted on tomorrow, contains another $145 billion for the war. And on top of that, they're putting another $50 billion for the war in fiscal year 2009. So this talk about ending the war by March or by September belies the fact that the budget has money in it to keep the war going into 2009. And I think that's wrong. I think the American people will reject that type of thinking. And I'm standing strong to say, get out now. I put forth a plan embodied in H.R. 1234 to accomplish just that.
But what do you say to those who make the argument that if President Bush has on his desk a bill that gives money, gives a fortune in continuing the war, and he has to veto it because he doesn't like the timetable, that this puts him in a very difficult position?
Our decisions have to be way above politics. We have the lives of our troops at stake here. There's no military victory in Iraq. We're there illegally. The occupation is fueling the insurgency. Democrats can still, after President Bush vetoes the bill, which he will, Democrats can still take the right position, which is refuse to fund the war, use money in the pipeline to bring the troops home.
What about the pressure from the leadership, the Democratic Party, from the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, all of the stories going around of Congress members voting for the funding so that they could help out the spinach farmers, et cetera?
On matters of war and peace, I think people have to vote their conscience. I can say I wasn't pressured.
But what about those that were, and what about the spending bill going way beyond funding war?
It's a legitimate concern. I mean, if you're for peace, you vote for peace. If you're for peace, you don't vote for war because somebody's giving you a plum in a bill that's designed to keep a war going. I think the American people want new leadership, which understands that if you're for peace, you vote for peace. You don't fund wars. And so I'm moving forward with a plan. It's embodied in H.R. 1234 that would stop the funding and the occupation, close the bases, bring the troops home, and set in motion a parallel process that would stabilize Iraq with the help of the international community, which will only help, by the way, if the United States takes a new course and ends the occupation. So my plan envisions that America will take a new direction. But what's happening right now, Amy, is we're looking in this budget, and people that, and Democrats that look at this budget today are going to be surprised to find out that our leaders are proposing keeping the war going into 2009.
Let me play a clip of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pushing for the passage of the supplemental spending bill. This was her comment after the bill passed.
Proudly, this new Congress voted to bring an end to the war in Iraq. It took one great giant step in that direction. It voted no to giving a blank check to an open-ended commitment to a war without end to the President of the United States, and yes, to begin the end of the war and the redeployment of our troops.
I then want to play for you a clip of President Bush. President Bush's comment after the House passed the spending bill last week.
This bill has too much pork, too many conditions, and an artificial timetable for withdrawal. As I've made clear for weeks, I will veto it if it comes to my desk. And because the vote in the House was so close, it is clear that my veto would be sustained. Today's action in the House does only one thing. It delays the delivery of vital resources for our troops.
Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, your response.
Well, it's the Democrats' position should have been and can still be that we refuse to fund the war, that we don't give this president a dime to keep the war going, that we use money in the pipeline to bring the troops home and set in motion a parallel process that would secure Iraq. We're under no obligation to keep this war going. But I would say, Amy, that if you look at the budget, which is facing Congress tomorrow, it provides not only $145 billion for fiscal year 08 for the war, for all of it, but another $50 billion for fiscal year 09. I wonder how that squares with Democratic leaders' position that they want to bring the troops home in March or in September of next year. There's something that's contradictory here. And so I'm going to try to see if I can reconcile that today in Congress by talking to leadership and alerting my fellow members that money is in the budget to keep this war going past President Bush's term. President Bush has been very clear. He's going to keep this war going through the end of his term. I say that America should get out now, that it's not a choice between President Bush or keeping the war going another year, year and a half. We need to get out now, and we need to let the troops know we truly support them by bringing them home.
Congressman Kucinich, what would getting out now look like? I mean, do you mean, for example, today you begin the process, and when would the soldiers be home if you were president, Dennis Kucinich?
I crafted my plan with the help of people at the UN, and I will tell you that they say that it would take about 2 months to 3 months to mobilize a sufficient force that would replace U.S. troops leaving. So I'd say 2 to 3 months we could have troops home and have an international force that would help stabilize Iraq. But the international community will not become involved as long as the United States intends to occupy Iraq and keep bases open. So we need to take a new direction. My plan would be as follows: to put in place the provisions of H.R. 1234, which ends the occupation, closes the bases, sets in motion a plan to bring the troops home, bring in international peacekeepers, and stop the privatization of Iraq oil. One of the things in the bill that passed the House was a demand that the Iraq government pass a Hydrocarbon Act, which sets the stage for broad privatization of trillions of dollars of Iraqi oil interests. Now think about it. If Democrats had told the American people last October that if you vote Democrat in November, we'll not only give you enough money to keep the war going through the end of President Bush's term, but we'll also privatize the oil of Iraq and then help the U.S. oil companies win the prize that I think the war was about all from the very beginning. I don't think the people would have voted Democrat. So Democrats have to keep faith with the American people. And my plan would do that by returning full control of the Iraqi oil assets to the Iraqi people, put in motion a plan for reconciliation between Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds, which cannot happen as long as the United States occupies, provide for honest reconstruction. You know, none of these contractors from the U.S. can be there. They've stolen money from the Iraqi people and also from the U.S. taxpayers. And we have to give the Iraqi people's jobs with Iraqi contractors doing the work. We have to provide for reparations so that we can pay money to the Iraqi people who have lost their homes or lost the lives of loved ones. We have to stabilize energy and food prices. And when Iraq goes to the international community, make sure that Iraq doesn't suffer from the structural readjustment provisions of the IMF or the World Bank.
Your response, Congressmember Kucinich, to Halliburton saying they're moving to Dubai?
Well, I think the honest thing would be to have a good attorney general call Halliburton in and start to question them about their conduct. And I think that they should not be immune from prosecution simply because they're moving to Dubai.
Congressmember Kucinich, we have to break. I'd like you to stay with us. And I do want to ask you also about other issues involving the attorney general as well as the president of the United States. Congressmember Kucinich, Ohio congressman and Democratic presidential hopeful. Stay with us.
Baby, I've been waiting night and day. I didn't see the time. I waited half my life away. There were lots of invitations. I know you sent me some.
Waiting for the miracle, Leonard Cohen, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Congressmember Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, Democratic presidential hopeful. He is standing just outside the Capitol right now. You mentioned Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. What do you think should happen to him?
It's very clear that the Justice Department has become so politicized that it cannot function in the interests of the American people. The honorable thing would be for Mr. Gonzalez to resign.
And if he doesn't resign, should he be fired? Should the president fire him?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I think he's doing what the president has asked him to do. The question here is, what's his sense of honor about his responsibility to the law and to the American people? That's going to be his decision.
Speaking of the president, what do you think should happen to President Bush? Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, said that impeachment is off the table. What are your thoughts?
I don't think that it's wise for the House and the Congress, a co-equal branch of government, to essentially give the president carte blanche with his decision-making by saying, no matter what you do, impeachment is off the table. I think that impeachment has to be on the table, and I also think that it's time to have a national conversation in cities and towns all over America about the appropriate conduct for a president and a vice president, about whether it's right for a president and vice president to lie to the American people and take us into war, about the erosion of civil rights in America and how that's come about as a result of this administration's conduct of the war. I think that it's time to have that kind of a discussion, and I've urged that from my website at Kucinich.us, and I'm asking to hear from people about what they think And I think that we need to make sure that this president understands that he can't do whatever he wants, that he is bound by the Constitution, that he is bound by national and international law.
Congressman Kucinich, you've mentioned the word treason. What do you mean?
I don't think I mentioned the word treason.
Have you talked about President Bush and treason?
No, I've never mentioned the word treason. I do think that accountability is a key word here. And I think the president and the vice president must be held accountable. That's why I think it's a mistake for anyone to say impeachment is off the table. At the same time, we have to take a responsibility as members of Congress to uphold the Constitution of the United States. That's our obligation as a co-equal branch of government. And so I'm waiting to hear from the American people. I would ask people who are listening or watching to go to my website at Kucinich.us. I'd like to hear from you. What do you think? Should the House move forward with a resolution of impeachment, and what do you think the dimensions of it should be? I want to hear from the American people on this.
What do you think of the Center for Constitutional Rights going to Germany to file a complaint against former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld? And it's not only against him, it's against Alberto Gonzalez, it's against General Sanchez and Miller for torture, over the issue of torture.
I think that all members of this administration, including the president, the vice president, and all the other officials you mentioned, should be held accountable under international law. And that accountability does not expire with the expiration of the term of this president. America, at some point, is going to have to restore its moral equilibrium, which has been lost because this administration took us into a war based on lies. They all have to be held accountable. They must be held accountable not only under national but international law.
When you came to the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, you talked about holding hearings around the FCC, heading up a committee that is responsible for the FCC. I think it's the Domestic Policy Subcommittee, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Right. What do you plan to do?
Well, our committee just started its work last week. The Domestic Policy Subcommittee has jurisdiction over the Federal Communications Commission. It's been 20 years since we've had any hearings at all on the Fairness Doctrine. It's been a long time since Congress has held hearings on the concentration in the electronic media. And so I want to proceed with hearings sometime in the next few months that would review those animating principles of the FCC embodied in the Federal Communications Act of 1934. And that is that the electronic media shall serve in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. I want to hold that up and see if today's condition corresponds to what it was that gave the public the inclination to cause electronic media to be licensed, and if the licensees have kept faith with the American people.
Congressmember Kucinich, you also just returned from New York, where you held a news conference on universal health care. How does your plan differ from, for example, Hillary Rodham Clinton, the New York senator, also Democratic hopeful, presidential hopeful, also said she supports universal health care?
It differs in every way. I mean, everyone in this campaign is for universal health care. But what Senator Clinton, Senator Edwards, and others are talking about is having the insurance companies still in charge of health care, of having the government subsidize the insurance companies, of forcing people to buy insurance or have the government subsidize the purchase of insurance. Look, a president of the United States shouldn't be an insurance salesman. A president should stand for a position where everyone is covered. That's what my bill does, the Conyers-Kucinich bill, and that's H.R. 676, Medicare for All. It ends for-profit medicine. It is a single-payer system which recognizes we're spending $2.2 trillion a year on health care, but 31% of that, or $660 billion, goes for the activities of the for-profit system. Take that money, put it into health care, and you have enough money to cover every medical need, including dental care, vision care, mental health, prescription drug, and long-term care. Health care is a right, it's not a privilege. Senator Clinton's plan helps the insurance companies, it keeps the for-profit system going, and my plan ends the for-profit system and uses the savings to provide health care for everyone.
What do you think of the media coverage of the Democratic presidential race right now? A lot of attention on both Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, Senator Obama and Clinton. Of course, last time you also ran for president, and there was a major issue the day after you took Ted Koppel to task at ABC for asking questions about polls and money as opposed to issues of your positions. The next day, the so-called embedded reporter in your campaign was Poll, the ABC reporter. What about the coverage now?
Well, my concern wasn't so much whether reporters were embedded in my campaign as much as it was the fact that mainstream media reporters were embedded with the war. But as far as my own campaign, look, I'm bringing issues forth to the American people. We're organizing in places like New Hampshire, where the Democratic Party just came out in favor of single-payer health care, not-for-profit. My campaign's about organizing door-to-door and grassroots fundraising, and people who want to get involved can go to Kucinich.us and help us. I'm not going to be on my knees begging for attention from the mainstream media. They have to realize that they have a responsibility as broadcast licensees to provide coverage to all the candidates. After all, this is an American idol. We're choosing a president of the United States, and the American people have the right to a substantive discussion about those issues that affect their lives, such as war and peace, such as poverty and prosperity, health care for all, or keep the insurance companies in business in health care. We need a new discussion, and I appreciate the chance to be on Democracy Now! Because I know your audience is an audience of people of principle, of activism, and I'm confident that when they hear what I stand for, they'll be interested in joining this campaign.
Finally, Congressmember Kucinich, the men and women who have gone AWOL, there have been thousands of them. Some are being court-martialed, like Lieutenant Aaron Watada will be court-martialed again. There was a mistrial in his first trial, first officer to say no to war, to deployment to Iraq. What do you think should happen to these men? Augustine Aguayo, an Army medic who applied for CO status, didn't get it, and is now in prison in Germany. Do you support their saying no? Do you support their refusing to go to Iraq or redeploy to Iraq?
I support the troops who serve and also those who don't feel it's right to serve. I think we have to ask our troops to be able to reserve the right of their conscience. And if they feel it's the right thing to go forward, then we support that. If they feel it's not the right thing, we should support that too. I think we're at a point in the history of this country where many people have looked at the war and realized that it's wrong. Some of those people are soldiers. Soldiers are put in an impossible situation, not only those who are committed to serving in Iraq, but also those who know that the war is wrong and have questioned the war. I think we have to love our troops, whatever their situation we find they find themselves in.
Do you think they should be court-martialed? Do you think they should be court-martialed?
I don't think that that anyone who's taken a principled and conscientious position should be subject to a court-martial. They should be permitted to leave the service if they so desire, but not be forced to that kind of a process. I think, you know, there has to be an underlying truth here. And the underlying truth is the war was wrong, period. The war is based on lies. We should support our troops by bringing them home, and we should support those who have challenged the war by giving them a chance to leave honorably.
Congressmember Kucinich, I want to thank you for joining us from the Capitol, Ohio, Congressmember and Democratic presidential hopeful.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community stations, on public access TV stations and PBS TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in audio and transcript form on our website at democracynow.org. Well, our next guest has been a leading figure in the book publishing world for nearly half a century. As head of Pantheon Books, Andre Schifrin edited titles by Jean-Paul Sartre, Studs Terkel, Art Spiegelman, Noam Chomsky, Michel Foucault. In 1990, he resigned Pantheon and set up the nonprofit publishing house, The New Press. Andre Schifrin has also written several of his own books, including The Business of Books, How International Conglomerates Took Over Publishing and Changed the Way We Read. He's just written a new memoir, It's called A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York. Andre Shiffrin joins us now in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy
Now!
Well,
thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, usually I know it's tradition to just delve into the book that you've just published, but in your work and in that first book where you talked about these multinational conglomerates, explain how publishing works. Who owns the publishing houses?
Well, publishing used to be what you could call artisanal. It was family firms that were many in number and had a wide choice of books and so on. And in the U.S. and, in fact, in Europe, made about 3 or 4% a year in the way of profit, which was enough to keep going, but not enough to make a huge amount of money. In recent years, through a long process which I described in the business of books, large media conglomerates have begun to buy more and more of publishing, people who own radio, television, cable, magazines, newspapers, and so on. And they, the five largest conglomerates, now control 80% of the books that are published in the U.S. For the general reader.
Give us some examples.
Well, Bertelsmann, of course, is the most notorious, which owns...
This is the German company.
The German company, which owns... Well, a lot of them are foreigners, which is interesting, which owns Random House, the Random House Group, Knopf, and so on. Holzbrink, another German conglomerate, owns... Farrar Straus and Macmillan and other firms that are very distinguished. Murdoch, of course, owns HarperCollins and has made it part of his empire.
When you say Murdoch, of course, owns HarperCollins, I don't think most people, in the same way when you go into a grocery store and it looks like there are a lot of choices and then you learn that all of these food companies, many of them are owned by the same company. The same in publishing, because they have different names. The imprints are different. People assume that they're competitors.
Right. People have maintained that illusion, and, of course, it's useful for them not to say, you know, yet another book published, brought to you by Rupert Murdoch, and so they keep the names of the old imprints. And the same thing happens in a bookstore. You know, when you go into a grocery store and you see a pile of Nabisco crackers, you don't think it's a staff pick. But when you go into a bookstore, you'll see a pile of books next to the cash register, and you don't know that that's been paid for, that the chains get a great deal of money from the publishers to highlight their books at the end of each counter or in front of the cashier's desk. And, of course, the whole point of that is to stress the bestseller and to cut back on the choice that people have had. So that makes an enormous difference. It makes a difference in what's available and what's being published, and also in the politics. One of the things that struck me the most on Iraq is that during the first 2 years of the Bush administration, the crucial years, not a single large publisher, none of the conglomerates published a book critical of what Bush was doing and what was going on in Iraq. And that was because they had other interests that went beyond the book market. They were interested, as Kucinich was saying, in what the FCC might do for them. They had all sorts of other irons in the fire. So this is something that's very dangerous. The newspapers, as we know, can make up to 26% as an average a year profit. The book publishers were making 3 or 4. Well, the solution was not to lower the profits of the newspapers. It was to try and raise the profits of the publishing houses. And that has meant a complete transformation of what's available from the larger houses, whole areas that used to be basic to their trade have disappeared. And though there are still some good publishers doing the best they can under the profit pressures, it's enormously changed the choice that Americans have.
Explain what happened to you at Pantheon. You were there for 30 years. When you first came, who was it owned by, and what happened by the end?
Right. Well, it was owned by Random House when I got there. It had been a small independent firm before, and Bennett Cerf and Donald Klopfer had bought Knopf at the time.
Who was Bennett Cerf?
Bennett Cerf was the well-known television personality, but also a great publisher who was head of Random House, as well as his partner, Donald Klopfer. And they ran a very good, old-fashioned American publishing house, featuring mostly American writers like O'Hara and Faulkner and so on. They then bought Alfred Knopf's firm, which had been the most distinguished publisher of books from abroad, from Japan, from Europe, and so on. And then for dessert, they bought Pantheon. And one of the things that we tend to forget is that American law is against the family firm, because everyone dies and everyone has to pay inheritance taxes. The corporation is immortal. And so there is always a pressure on a publishing house to sell out, which is what happened to Bennett Cerf and Random House. They sold out to RCA. at the time when all the electronics giants, Raytheon and others, were trying to buy up publishing houses. That was the time of Wall Street's believing in synergy, which turned out, as is the case with many things that Wall Street believes in, to be mythical. And so after that, they sold, RCA got out, they sold the firm to Condé Nast, owned by Cy Newhouse, who owns Vogue and a lot of television and radio and so on. And when he came in, he said he didn't want to change anything in what we were doing. It became very clear very soon that he was unhappy both with the quality of the material, which was too high, not too low, and also with the politics. And so after a few years...
How did it become clear?
Well, in 1990, and I described this in the book, the man he'd put in charge of the firm, a former banker called Alberto Vitali, came to us and said, we'd like you to cut out two-thirds of your list, and all the books that would have been the Foucaults and the others that were not sure bestsellers.
Explain who Michel Foucault is.
Well, he was one of the many important French philosophical figures that we published, and he still is a great influence and probably one, after Sartre, the most important of the French philosophers of the last century. But also he was very unhappy with what we were publishing politically, with the Chomskys and the others that we had published over the years. And Vitali said to us, why can't you publish more books on the right rather than those on the left? And it was clear to us at that point that we were in a situation where there was no compromise, no solution. So all of my colleagues and I resigned at the same time, which is something that normally doesn't happen in publishing. When there's a new owner, everybody says, oh, well, let's see, maybe we can work it out, and we don't want to leave our corner offices and so on. But we did leave altogether.
Many of you?
Well, there were six who left altogether, the editorial staff. And there was a big picket line outside of Random House. There was a lot of noise about it, protests from all over Europe and so on. And it was clear that people saw that as a sea change, a moment when the conglomerates would really try to alter, as they had been doing, what was published. And so because it was such a famous incident, I was able to start a not-for-profit house based on the idea of NPR or PBS called the New Press, which is now celebrating its 15th anniversary. And we had the manuscripts. We had our best-selling authors like Studs Terkel and others who stayed loyal to us very courageously.
Leaving Pantheon and
right,
joining.
Right. Of all the hundreds, if not thousands, of authors I had published at Pantheon over the 30 years, only two stayed behind.
Who stayed behind?
Well, I don't want to embarrass them. And one of them because they had an agent who wanted them to stay behind. But most of the authors understood that this was a major crisis and a major change in American publishing. And even in other firms, you've seen people like Kurt Vonnegut leaving the Bertelsmann Group with his famous novels and going to a tiny publisher called Seven Stories. So that increasingly there are other alternatives. There are small houses, some of them formally... de facto not-for-profit as we are, some de jure, some de facto, they're not making a lot of money. But there is an attempt, both here and in Europe, to have an alternative to the conglomerates.
We're talking to André Chiffrin. He's written a new book about his own life, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York. We'll be back with him in a minute.
Clean clothes, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
Subterranean Homesick Blues, Bob Dylan, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Andre Shifrin. The legendary publisher was at Pantheon for 30 years and then founded a new publishing house in 1990 called The New Press. It's an independent. What does it mean to be a nonprofit publishing house?
Well, it means that you don't have shareholders. You don't have people who are going to say, we want 10% at the end of the year, or 5% or whatever, or 20% as the conglomerates want. So that we have the advantage of taking on books that can just break even. And that is unfortunately the case with many important books, perhaps most important books. In fact, when I started in publishing, the head of Doubleday, the largest American commercial firm, used to say they weren't expecting to make money out of any of their hardcover books. They made money out of the paperbacks and the book clubs and so on. So publishing is a place where you have to take risks, where you have to know that you're not going to make an enormous amount of money in the short term. And if you have shareholders now who say, we want more immediately, then you're in trouble.
Let's talk about Studs Terkel. Mm-hmm. How did you find him?
Well, Studs Terkel had written one children's book before I met him, and I started reading some of his interviews, his marvelous interviews, in the magazine that used to be published by his radio station, WFMT. And I realized that he was an exceptional interviewer, that he actually listened to people, which very few people do, and respected them, and could get things out of them that no one else had done before. And I asked him if he would consider writing a book about Chicago, which he called Division Street, and which became a bestseller. And
did you expect it to be a bestseller?
No. I didn't think it would do as well as it did. But ever since then, we've never looked back. And what he's done, in effect, is write an oral history of America since the Depression, or even before. But there's a footnote to that, in that Studs was blacklisted during the McCarthy period. He had been one of the most popular television personalities in the 40s and 50s, what was called the Chicago School. He and David Garraway, who later became famous as well, were extremely popular. But with the McCarthy period, Studs, who says he'd never met a petition he didn't like, found that he couldn't get any work at all. And so part of what I was trying to do at Pantheon in the early 60s was to see if we could undo some of the harm done intellectually and politically by the McCarthy period.
When Studs was on Democracy Now!, he described how he was doing radio with Mahalia Jackson.
Right.
And they said, no, he could no longer be the host with her. And she said, then there would be no show.
Right. Right, and he's very proud of that, and it's a great moment. But it also shows, as Studs says, how few people actually stood up against that system. And one of the things I try to do in this book is to look at the McCarthy period and look at the changes that took place and the cowardice, really, that was abroad in the country at that time. Because one of the curious things, as you look at Kucinich talking today in favor of national health insurance, Truman wanted to do that in 48. The Fair Deal program had full employment, it had much more equality, it had all sorts of issues that were at that time looking very possible. And when I was in school, I talk about the fact that even our high school newspaper published by Scholastic, which went to all the schools in the country, were discussing issues of that kind. They were even discussing, should we nationalize railroads and mines as the
Europeans? This was the Weekly Reader.
It was the Weekly Reader, absolutely. I later met and got to know Truman's chief economic advisor, who told me that the debates within the administration was whether 2% unemployment was acceptable or whether you could go as high as 3. And recently I heard somebody who worked with the Community Service Society in New York saying that the unemployment rate for all black and Latino men, 16 to 64, not school dropouts, all of them, is 39.6. And nobody talks about it. It's not a major issue. It's not a subject of debate or something that either the Republicans or the Democrats feel is something that can be talked about. So the question in my book, in part, is how have we come so far from where we were in the post-war period?
I want to talk about that pivotal time, the McCarthy era, but go back where you begin your book, and that's going back to France, going back to your own family, your father and your mother. Talk about your background.
Well, I was born in France in 1935, in what was then a very pleasant time to be there. My father was a publisher, a very famous publisher in France. And when the war came and the Germans...
Explain his publishing house and what he was publishing.
Well, he had invented a new form called a collection of classics from France and the rest of the world called the Pléiade, which has since become one of the staples of French publishing. It's the books that practically all educated French people try to have in their homes and has become a real institution. And he ended up working for the big publishing house called Gallimard, which bought up this collection when it was so successful he didn't have the money to keep it growing. But the Germans had the bad idea of walking into Paris on my fifth birthday, and very shortly thereafter...
So your parents had your birthday the day before?
They had the birthday the day before. They knew it was about to happen, and of course Paris was practically deserted at the time. And one of the first things the Germans did, who were very sophisticated in their occupation policy, was to Aryanize, as they called it, a key cultural institution.
Aryanize.
Right. And so Gallimard, in order to keep going, had to fire the two Jews who were working in his firm, my father among them.
And how did they explain that to your father and to the rest of the staff?
Right. No, it was a demand of the German occupying authorities, and so it was a question of, do you want to continue in publishing and also accept a lot of fascists to direct the intellectual content of the firm, or do you want to go out of business? And Gallimard made that choice, which in a way was a collaborationist choice, as did a great many French people. And my father obviously was without a job and had to leave the country as quickly as possible, which was very difficult at that time. The American foreign policy wanted to exclude as many European Jews as they possibly could.
This is not a history that's known very well in this country, of the level of anti-Semitism in the U.S. government at
right.
the time.
Right, which was enormous. And we published a book called The Abandonment of the Jews by David Wyman, which is a history of how this went and how thorough it was, how complete it was. And thanks to an American, a very courageous American journalist called Varian Fry, we were able to get help and to get out. But he was able to say, he was sent to save the famous intellectuals and union leaders and people of that kind. He managed to save 2,000 people out of the tens of thousands who wanted to be saved.
Among others?
Well, among the list ended up being a very famous list of Marc Chagall, the painter, and Hannah Arendt, who became famous as a political scientist. A lot of the German socialists and trade union leaders who had found refuge in France and then discovered that the French, in their armistice agreement with the Germans, had said they would hand them over to the Germans whenever they wanted.
Your family was very friendly with both André Gide and Hannah Arendt.
Right. Well, Gide had worked with my father from the beginning of his publishing career in the 1920s, and we just published a book of their correspondence in France, which was well over 300 pages, describing their relationship. Arendt we got to know in New York when there was a small refugee community of which she was a part. And now she's become one of the most famous of the political scientists, and her centennial is being celebrated this year. What people forget is that she was unable to get a university job for well over 12 years after arriving. And that's again part of the story, that the refugee community did not become as integrated as we like to think.
Hannah Arendt, famous for, among other works, The Mundanity of Evil.
Right, right.
Talking about how when you look at who these people were, who were responsible for so much death.
Right, right. No, she was famous for the banality of evil. As the slogan of her book, it was the Eichmann trial that she covered when she did that, but also a marvelous book called The Origins of Totalitarianism. And part of what I describe in the book is the intellectual feeling of this refugee community, where I went to study with Hannah Arendt when I was still in high school, and we went to a small socialist adult education school called the Rand School, and there were six people in the class, four garment workers, my mother and myself, and that was well before she got a professorship at Chicago and Princeton and elsewhere. But one of the questions which I try to discuss in the book is, why was there really so little willingness to accept ideas from abroad in America at the time and since? Of course, now we're so much more isolationist, intellectually speaking, that those look like the good old days. But there was both a reluctance to accept ideas from abroad and also an incredible amount of anti-Semitism in the universities. Harvard, Yale, Princeton had one Jewish professor each. Columbia, being in New York, I suppose was under greater pressure. They had two. But that's part of the life in America that we didn't realize. And even when I applied to Yale, it was clear that there was still an enormous amount of anti-Semitism in their selection of students.
How did the U.S. come out of the McCarthy period?
Well, it came out, I'm afraid, in much worse shape, because McCarthy had been an opportunistic politician who really had no ideology as such. He simply wanted to embarrass the Democrats, and he claimed that there were communists in the State Department, so on, when there weren't any. And the names that he used to wave around had no meaning and no validity whatsoever. But he managed to terrify everyone, and even Eisenhower refused to defend his former colleague and partner, George Marshall, the head of the American forces in Europe, when McCarthy called him a traitor at the time. So you had an extraordinary period of fear. And one of the things that I discovered later was that there was a full-time FBI office at Yale, for instance, and at Harvard and elsewhere, universities that were very conservative in their time and had no conceivable hint of subversion. So the idea was really to frighten people from having any ideas at all. And the Cold War had started, of course, but there should be no logical relationship between Stalin occupying Czechoslovakia and the end of national health insurance. But that is, in effect, what happened. Truman was put so much on the defensive by McCarthy that all the ideas he was putting forward in the Fair Deal disappeared.
Would you say the media brought McCarthy down? I mean, Good Night and Good Luck, George Clooney's film, Edward Murrow, you know, taking him on?
Well, that took a long time. The media created McCarthy, I'm afraid, more than took him down. It took a long time. And by the time we reached the great Edward R. Murrow period, we know that because he was attacking the army, McCarthy was in danger. And there were the McCarthy army hearings, which marked the end of his career when he'd just gone too far in attacking a sacred institution. But for the most part, the press was scared. And I mentioned in the book the fact that 10 years after the McCarthy hearings, I was in the office of the New York Review of Books when Bob Silvers had commissioned the great American muckraking journalist I.F. Stone to do an article. And Silvers was very worried that people would consider the New York Review to be a communist front, that they would cancel their subscriptions and so on, 10 years after McCarthy had been deposed. So the chill that spread over America lasted a very long time.
What gives you hope today?
Well, I think, like everyone, there is some hope that when you have a total disaster, as we've had in the Bush administration, people will say enough. You know, we can't go on like this. And certainly the elections and even some of the Supreme Court decisions have been very helpful in that way. But the media themselves have only gradually begun to change in their coverage. There's a lot more that needs to be done in analyzing what the administration claims are and confronting them with the news that you can get elsewhere in the world. The difference between the way a French newspaper would cover or an English newspaper would cover the news and the way we do here is very substantial and surprising.
Explain that difference as we wrap up. You're heading back to France this week.
Right. Well, part of it, of course, is that the Europeans, having had their colonial wars, know how disastrous they were and opposed the Iraqi war from the beginning. But even in their coverage of Afghanistan, they'll point out mistakes, constant mistakes that are made that we don't know about here. And that, of course, makes a big difference. The leading English newspaper, The Guardian, is owned by a foundation, by a not-for-profit foundation called the Scott Trust. And so they don't have any pressures of the kind that we see here.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much. Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York is Andre Schifrin's book. His independent publishing house is called The New Press. It's celebrating its 15th anniversary. Thanks so much for joining us. Tomorrow on Thursday, I'll be at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, on Friday at the Barrymore Theater in Madison, and on Saturday in Hayward, Wisconsin. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Shufab Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Thanks also to Angela Alston, Andrew Quinn, Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Julian O'Connor, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, and Samantha Chambly. Our website, again, is democracynow.org. You can get our transcripts, audio, and videos of the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.